The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets Live. My name is Paul Hill. I'm delighted again to be able to speak to equity analyst and stock markets commentator Paul Scott to discuss all things small caps. So massive welcome, Paul.
Thanks, Paul, and hello, everyone at home. You'll be pleased to know I've actually bought an Ethernet cable, so we've actually got stable internet today. So sorry for last week's debacle. That was my fault.
No problems at all. Yeah, it's great to be back on the show. Only minor technical issues, but we've had a sort of like, again, a fairly slow last couple of weeks on corporate news. It's now starting to, the pace is starting to pick up a bit. But have you been buying or selling anything over the past fortnight?
Negligible. I did actually buy something this morning, actually, something I mentioned in last night's podcast, which was Warpaint W7L. I'm taking a bit of a risk here because the stock is basically in free fall. I don't know why. There hasn't been any particular news, but I take the view that, you know, if you buy a basket of these things, you're going to get the odd one that'll put out a profit warning and you just accept that risk. Yeah, look at that. I bought them at £2.86. I think at that level, I'm prepared to just take a flyer on it. Only a small position, dip my toe in. We're getting quite a few things with similar shape graphs at the moment, just indiscriminate sell-offs. Those are the times to be buying, in my view, not panic selling.
Yeah. What about, I understand you bought Shield Therapeutics a few weeks ago, which I think does a sort of like a well-tolerated iron deficiency drug, sells out to the States. What was the sort of the thesis behind that one?
Well, I actually watched a webinar with management. I thought, well, this sounds interesting. I mean, there are downside risks with it. So I am treating this as a relatively high risk punt, if you like. But yeah, it's a well-tolerated iron deficiency treatment that doesn't have the drawbacks of the others. And it's selling very well and fast growing in America through one main distributor. So you have got, you know, single point of failure risk, if you like, in that 90% of their revenues comes through one distributor. But the growth is what really impressed me. Cash burn, balance sheet are all a high risk. But it's saying, it's Shield is saying that they're going to reach cash flow break even by the end of this calendar year. Now, it depends how they define cash flow break even, isn't it? Because, as you know, different companies have wildly varying amounts. So it is high risk. It is a bit precarious in terms of its finances. But and it wouldn't surprise me if they do a top up placing. When you've got a share price that looks like that, it makes sense to do a top-up placing. So, you know, but that would only dilute by maybe 10, 15, 20%, which isn't the end of the world. And it does seem to be achieving exponential growth with actual product, you know, it's not blue sky. This is product that is selling and starting to take off. And they've got other countries starting to come on stream as well. So it's not my area of expertise. Did we mention this before, Paul, a couple of weeks ago?
Now, what was the balance sheet like on it?
Oh, it's pretty bad. Yeah, but it's being propped up by big shareholder loans, which you could say good or bad. But the fact that the major shareholder doesn't want to dilute and is happy to give it loans is good, but they're quite expensive. The finance cost is soaring. Also, it took an advance on some royalties from China, I think, from another connected party, but it had to basically give them half the money in return for getting an advance on it. So they're clearly stretched. You know, the balance sheet is definitely stretched. There's no arguments about that. But it's bearing down on cash flow break even at such a pace that I'm taking a bit of a pump that it'll get there and won't need an emergency sort of massively dilutive raise. But that's why I am flagging this as definitely higher risk, not for widows and orphans.
Yeah. No, I know a bit about sort of iron deficiency. I mean, I have anemia myself, so I take a daily iron. Yeah, I take a daily anemia iron tablet. It isn't actually prescribed, obviously, on the NHS, but there's two types. There's ferrous sulfate and there's ferrous gluconate, and they both carry salts. And the problem with the salts is that you get less iron absorption, and unfortunately, you get constipation, which is, for me... It's not a major issue, but I know it's a real problem for people who are having chemotherapy, because when you have chemotherapy, it blasts 10 bells out of your blood cells, red blood cells. And therefore, you need iron tablets. And of course, then you really struggle going to the toilet when you're going through chemotherapy. But I can understand there's actually a demand in this for, I mean, it's the sort of the, you know, the creme de la creme type treatment for iron deficiency, and that's why the states have opted for it. Whereas the, I don't think the NHS have really sort of like used it much because it's too expensive. But
yeah, something like that's interesting background. Thanks, Paul. I mean, it's something like $300 per prescription, I believe. So you're right; it is a fairly expensive treatment. But they've only got 10 years left on the patents. That's the other key point on this to bear in mind. So you basically got a 10-year cash flow up to 2035. So it's got to, you know, hit the ground.
Yeah.
Well, it has hit the ground running, and it's just the pace of growth, you know. And of course, China, of course, could be massive. I mean, all these international markets could be massive, but you've got to be aware of the risks and the fact that you've probably just got a 10-year runway here, which may or may not. So it's a sort of share where doing a discounted cash flow type analysis would make complete sense, you know. One product, finite lifetime. Of course, I haven't done that. I'm just treating it as a bit of a punt, really.
It's interesting. I must admit, I have looked at it before, so I know a bit about it. It's an intelligent little play, that one.
You could mystery shop it, Paul. Speak to the board.
I think it's about £200 a month or something like that. Whereas my ferrous glutenate is about to like a fiver for 4 months. So there's a bit of a difference on the cost base. Yeah. Okay. If anybody wants to ask Paul any questions, please put them into the chat box and I'll read them out. We've got top of the tree. We've got 10 Coleman. He's asking about Ashtead Technology, which is the marine services business. Basically came out with some results just recently, and the shares spiked up actually on the sort of the better outlook. But I think it was an in line. It was just people were fearing the worst. What's your sort of like your view on this one, but also more broadly in that oil field services sector, because oil is still around about $70 a barrel. And a lot of sort of like players in that sector are cautious on the outlook.
They are. Yeah. I mean, the outlook on Hunting, that's the only one I own personally. That was a bit mixed. So it's a tricky sector, isn't it, at the moment, but that's reflected in very low prices. So the latest news from Ashtead Technology was H1 results came out just a few days ago on the 26th of August. My colleague John did a write-up on this. We think it's good value. It's come off a lot from the previous highs, and the operating profit, adjusted EPS rather, was up 15% for its H1 results. So pretty good results, we thought. We do have some balance sheet concerns. We think the debt is a little high on Ashtead Tech, but not a deal breaker. So to cut to the chase, we think it's not bad, actually. We marked it amber, but I think it probably should have been amber green. I think it's a good company. Very cyclical, though. You do have to bear that in mind.
Yeah. No, I did actually speak to a fund manager about it a couple of weeks ago, Paul Jordan of Amati, and he likes it as well. He owns it. I mean, it trades at around just less than 9x PE. Which is hitting all of these oil field companies, is this cautious outlook. And as you rightly point out, it is cyclical. So Halliburton, for instance, came out with a very cautious statement over in the States. And likewise, Techmar, I know it's a much smaller business in sort of like subsea cables. They came out with some misdelayed contracts. It's across the whole patch. So if you are going to go fishing in this area, I think you probably need to go for the ones with the good balance sheets to be able to, to tell you. And one thing I would note, I did actually have a quick look the other day about, the UK's most shortest stock.
Oh, yeah.
And guess what is top of it?
Oh, I wouldn't like to guess.
It's Ashtead Technology. Most shortest stock. Yeah, it's increased significantly. I think it's about 7.5% shorted compared to it was less than 1% in January. So it keeps getting sort of these traders and fund managers who are looking to to profit on it going south. So it's a difficult one, but it does seem that the results do seem to have actually troughed out, and the shares was a bit of a relief rally.
Yeah, that's all very interesting. And also, I should also flag, on the day after the H1 results, we made a note that four non-execs have bought shares, and the chairman at Ashtead Tech spent 115 grand buying shares. Yeah. Now, that's not for PR, is it? You know, I sit up and take notice when directors purchases get into six figures, certainly, or anything above 50 grand, to me, they're not doing it because the PR said, oh, get a director buy through, it'll help the share price. So I thought that was quite significant potentially. And as you say, maybe the recent rally, the chart pattern looks like it's bottomed out. Maybe there's some short covering buying going on as well. So quite an interesting trade potentially, we think.
Is there any read across at all to a stock that you own, old Plexus?
No, I don't think so. Plexus is just, it's company specific. They've got they're rebuilding a rental fleet, and there's loads of demand for it in the Middle East, basically. So I don't think there's any read across on Plexus. I think it's just on the back burner, and I'll wait 6 months, a year, and see what happens, basically.
Okay, good. We've got a question from Paul the Parrot. He's asking about Hilton Foods, which I think came out with a bit of a mild profit warning today, albeit the shares are sort of like reflecting it's been a major profit warning. I think the last time I saw, they were down about 15, 20%. What was your sort of take on this one? It does sort of like meat and sort of seafood and stuff like that, which goes into the big multiples or grocers around the world.
Yeah, that's right. We were scratching our heads on this morning as well, actually. I've got the wrong page up, I think, but I'll do it from memory. Yeah, it reported, as you say, this was actually an inline update. That's what's so perplexing about what happened. I mean, they wangled it a bit, and we did notice that one of the brokers, Shore Capital, reduced its 25 and 26 forecasts by 3% and 2%. That's negligible, really. So why the shares have dropped down 19% when we last looked today? So the only, John and I, one of my co-writers, we were just scratching our heads, puzzling over this. I mean, the only conclusion we could come to is that maybe the premium brokers have possibly marked it down because, you know, in terms of maybe cut the forecast quite significantly. Because it did say something about cod, didn't it? Prices of cod were causing it problems. And
yeah, whitefish.
Yeah, whitefish. Yeah, so this is what we've found tends to happen. If you just see a mild or inline, I've marked it as a mild profit warning just because the share price is down 19%. Clearly, some information has gone out to some of these premium brokers saying that all's not well, but it wasn't explained in the RNS. So this is really annoying. This happens much too often. So we're not happy with this. Having said all of that, we wouldn't buy Hilton Foods almost at any price. It's very, very low, wafer thin margin, something like, 1.5% PBT margin on 4 billion revenues or something. So just in a competitive sector, just seems a low quality business. However, I did flag today that the dividends are worth looking at. It's been raising its dividends consistently for about 20 odd years. And after today's fall, the yield, I think, is up at about 5 or even 6%. And the balance sheet's not too bad. It does have about 200 million net debt. But we're not madly keen. But for dividend hunters, I would say Hilton Food might be worth you having a look at after today's rise and drop. And of course, we'll probably find in two or three days' time, the broker consensus numbers will have probably gapped down as all the premium information that we don't get feeds through. So it's a very unsatisfactory situation, really, the way information is selectively disclosed, which is of course not what is meant to happen.
Do you know why the margins are so much thinner than they are at Cranswick, which does sort of like, again, meat products but more processed?
I don't know, Paul. I've never really, it's not really a sector that I'm interested in buying into. Yeah. So I've never really, but I know I have sort of vaguely followed Cranswick for many, many years. And it just seems a much, much better quality business than Hilton Foods. And I think Premier Foods is not bad, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
But to my mind, if you do want to buy into food thing, you want something with a pricing power, so something that's making a kind of 10% operating margin, not a 1 or 2% operating margin, in my view.
I think it's something to do with basically because it's more processed, the Cranswick, more, they add more value, they put sort of like sauces and this sort of stuff, the shelf life is longer and therefore you get less returns because you can get sold by the customer. Whereas if they go straight meat, then you have, obviously, unless it's frozen, then I think basically you get more sort of like distressed stock and therefore it's more wastage. But that'd be my only I think it is, because obviously packaged food with premium foods is, you know, the time scale for those things is ages, isn't it?
Yeah, makes sense. But I doubt whether you would ever invest in this sector either, really, would you, Paul?
No, it isn't one for me. Okay, we got Letizia09. He's asking about Watches of Switzerland, the luxury jeweler who has stores in the UK and the US. Came out with a reassuring trading update. The shares up 8% today.
Yeah, we thought that. I read that, so I thought, this is really surprising. I would have been expecting something much, much more negative, but it actually came up with a positive update. However, when you dig into the detail of Watches of Switzerland, and again, my co-writer John wrote up a section on this, we feel quite a bit of it could be pull forward demand because of the tariff situation. It said trading it was strong, particularly in the US, but it then goes on to say that there was large inventory build-up by the either by themselves or by the customers. I'm not sure exactly which it was, or maybe people are buying them in anticipation. Yeah, I think maybe that's it, that the end customers are buying them now in perception of them being 30-40% dearer maybe next year. So pulled forward demand is our view on it, but we still think it looks attractive value, actually, and the balance sheet's all right. So tariff concerns remain is our one point on it, but we think it's probably cheap enough to mean that's factored in. So we quite like it.
Good. I would agree. Okay, let's move to another company we've talked about a lot. Gordon is asking about Traxys, which is basically the rail tech hardware business. Came out with a results or trading update, I think it was last week or 2 weeks ago. Pretty reassuring. They seem to have troughed out the numbers now, bottomed on it, and the shares responded very favourably. What was your take on it?
Positive. Yeah, we've been green on this one 4 or 5 times this year in succession. You've got to remember we did have that profit warning, didn't we, on the 24th of April that absolutely clobbered it. And you and I both bought in around about that time. But I think we were both remarkably astonished at how it bounced about 50 or 60%. So we thought, well, that's achieved in a few weeks what we thought it might take a couple of years to achieve. So I think independently of each other and at different times, we both banked our profits. I think it's now in buying range again, I have to say. 27th of August, that was just a few days ago, wasn't it? We had an inline trading update for July 25. The only thing I would say is that it seems to me that with Traxys, it's kind of lost its growth mojo. It's all a bit, revenue was flat, EBITDA was down 2% for the July year end, and it talks about market headwinds persisting, modest growth. It's a bit boring now, isn't it, really? It's not, it's almost like
I'm not sure it's boring.
Well, it's gone from growth stock to almost value share, hasn't it? So maybe that's why the shares are now looking cheap. I think I'd like to see some evidence that the growth engine is firing on all cylinders again. But we think it's a quality company, but with end market challenges. So what's your current take, Paul? And did you go back in? Have you bought back in?
No, I haven't bought back in yet. I mean, I just think it's just a reflection of the sector. I mean, the sector's contracting. It's two biggest markets by far and away the UK. You've seen the difficulty with the network rail, i.e. CP7. You've also had the ending of the franchise, rail franchises, and then the creation of the Great British Railway. I mean, this is, to me, is just an outcome. It's just a formula of the sector being really tough. And also, you have 10% of its revenues are out in the States. And with Trump coming in, they've also been pulling back the horns in terms of, your rail control monitoring, which they do there. So I actually think they haven't done a bad job, actually, to have a flat line in a decreasing market. So if you took it as a sort of like the lens that they're beating the competition, then I would say, actually, they're doing pretty well.
Yeah, that's an interesting take on it, actually. That's my feeling with several other sectors as well, actually. We had, for example, just briefly, Churchill China today put out H1 results that were 30-odd% down. But as they said in their commentary, look, the whole market globally is awful. We're actually holding our own. And, I think people need to be a bit more forgiving, maybe, investors. I think these knee-jerk, oh, my God, it's terrible. Well, what do they expect? The global economy is stagnant, So I'm a bit more forgiving. And I'm particularly looking at companies that are working to improve their operating margins. We were discussing this on my Substack today, the readers. You know, if you can't get top line growth, if demand's dead, you want to focus on just making the business that much more efficient, automating, cutting costs, and then you're set to go, aren't you, when the market does return. So I think that's an important area to be focusing on, companies that are actually increasing operating margins despite tough macro, and that will maybe give you an idea of who are going to be the winners in the next bull phase, maybe.
Yeah, no, I would agree. Just on that subject of sort of like improving margins and bucking the trends, you've got Avingtraz, you've got Amanda. She's asking about it. Basically, is a specialist niche engineer that serves the data center space, nuclear, defense, and rail. And just over the last 2 weeks, has announced two contract wins. Effectively, one in the rail sector with HS2 blast-proof doors, and then obviously this week supplying some nuclear pumps into South Korea, not yes. North Korea. So it's actually it is winning real contracts. The shares have responded well. The sum of the parts, though, are still significantly higher than where the current shares. I don't know if your take on this sort of specialist engineer.
Yeah, we had a look at this. This was yesterday, I think, wasn't it? I mean, it's doing well. It's impressive, as you say. I don't think it was North Korea, was it? Surely not.
No, South Korea. South Korea.
Yeah, I thought you said North Korea.
I didn't start. I corrected myself. Definitely South Korea.
Definitely South Korea. Yeah. It said, it won these new contracts, $16 million, didn't it? That was the Taylor something or other. Not Taylor Swift, that's something else, isn't it? Something Taylor engineering subsidiary. We think it's good. We think it's a good business. The earnings growth is impressive at Avingtraz. The only thing, I mean, we're on my Substack, we're value investors, you know, so everything is through that prism really of value and GARP. And we can't, given that Avingtraz shares have had such a strong run, we're struggling to see more upside, because I think Harwood have previously said their sum of the parts valuation was £4.95. Well, that's pretty much where it's got to now. So the way all we're saying is, well, we think, yes, they were obviously right about the sum of the parts valuation, but now that it's reached that level, surely you would probably be banking your profits and moving on, and unless you think it's going to smash the forecast. So I don't know. What do you think, Paul? Over to you.
Yeah, I mean, normally for this quality of engineering business, they trade at some round about sort of 10 to 15 times EBITDA, depending on what sector. I mean, obviously, nuclear and data centers you'd move more towards that. Overall, the whole group only trades at 8.3 times EBITDA. And that's also because, you know, that's hidden, that's disguised, because the medical division is draining, it's a negative on EBITDA. So actually, it's The way Singer's value it is that the engineering business is worth £5.80 on a standalone basis, and then the medical division is between £2.50 and £4 on top. So you can see how significantly more value. I just point your comments in terms of, you know, you look for companies that have got really strong secular growth trends behind them and a winning market share, because the rail sector's tough, and to win those two big contracts is you got to tip the hat to these guys.
Yeah, well, that was really well explained, actually. That explains why probably, I mean, we're just doing quick reviews, you know, of over 700 companies, so we don't really drill down to that level of detail. So because the headline numbers didn't really interest us, PE of about 24, 25 or something. So we just moved on. But I think the way you've explained it, in that you do take out the loss-making one and then value the two bits separately, that makes complete sense to me. Yeah. So, yeah.
Good. Got Andrew Kay is asking about Grainger, which is the UK's largest landlord, like all the property companies and the house builders, with bond yields being elevated. You've got your 10-year gilt now about 4.9%, your 30-year at about 5.7%.
Yes.
With higher funding costs, all of them have been absolutely whacked. And he's saying what the latest view. And just as a disclosure, I've actually topped up my position this week because I've taken on board the weakness in the shares. But what's your take on it?
I don't really have a current view on this. This is the one where you and I spoke to the corporate affairs guy, wasn't it? What an interesting session that was. I learned a lot about the sector and about the company. I think it's very good. But yeah, as you say, it would make sense, wouldn't it, that with bond yields globally, it's not just I think the media are reporting this as a UK specific problem, which it isn't at all. It's I mean, the high level of index linked UK gilts is probably the issue, but yeah, gilts everywhere globally are rising strongly, aren't they? So we don't know what happens with that, but I think Grainger is just fundamentally a very good this is the one where there were various levers, weren't they, where they think they've got lots of opportunities to raise the earning. I think it's a good choice, I have to say, but we do also have to be realistic here and say that, you know, 4.5-5% yields were amazing when interest rates were zero. Now they're not amazing at all, are they, really?
Yes. No, you're right. I would say it's just converted to a REIT, so it's tax efficient. If you hold this in your ISA or your SIP, the company will pay no corporation tax, obviously, and you'll pay no tax on your income. So it all comes straight through. So there's no sort of tax leakage at all, which has just happened. And then I would also say, and this is a bit hypothetical, but you always got to look at optionality and potential upside. In the autumn budget, if you have a look at what's been sort of like talked about in the mainstream press, they're thinking of stopping the main residence exemption for capital gains. If you sell your own house, then they're saying that actually they'll you know, they're thinking about the capital gain that somebody gets will then be taxed as it is normally with the stock of shares, as occurs out in the States. Now, if they ever decided to implement that, what that would mean would you'd get total sort of like gridlock in the housing market for people selling, because elderly people wouldn't want to actually crystalline a capital gains and then five months later or 10 years later, whatever it was, then pay an IHT on if they had to actually die. So that would reduce the supply of houses into the market, which would boost house prices. And of course, Grainger owns about 11, the most amount of houses as a landlord in the UK. So that would be beneficial to them if house prices went up. It would also be very beneficial for the house builders, because they would be then selling into less competition for new homes. So all I would say is that I've topped up simply because I think there's a bit of optionality if the government make a mistake and stop the exemption for main residents. Plus, I think with the REIT now being in place, this is just as a matter of just letting, you know, bond yields normalize. Unless you think they're going to go crazy, bond yields normalize and the business will do very well. So, yeah, that's the reason why I topped up.
That's interesting. Yeah, because I think the original proposal was for £500,000 plus, wasn't it, where CGT went? And they quickly upped it to £1.5 million, didn't they? But it would probably be, if they do introduce that would be a catastrophic change for many owner-occupiers, as you say, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
And could really have widespread negative consequences.
It could give Angela Rayner another problem.
Yes.
bum. Okay, we've got Ben Sharman. He's asking about premium brick manufacturer in the UK, Michelmersh, came out with half year results. A little soft, actually. They had a problem with their Carlton facility in the UK, less bricks. They had to take it down about 3 million. And they've had problems out in Benelux as well. Shares sold off hard, but then came back late play yesterday. What was your overall take on the business?
Well, we noticed, again, we reported on this yesterday, I think. We noticed a distinct change in tone from what they were saying earlier this year. And I do think there's read across from this. And I think that's possibly why quite a few of the building products and housing building shares are off quite a bit this week. It's all building a picture, isn't it, of a housing and building sector that's gone soft again. You know, we've been waiting a year and a half really for a meaningful recovery, and some of the house builders were starting to put out more positive sounding vibes in the spring. But from what Michelmersh said yesterday, it looks as if it's really ground to a halt. Although they did say, actually, I should correct that slightly, they did say the very challenging markets were in Europe. not the UK. And we're hearing this from quite a lot of companies at the moment. Actually, they're saying the UK is performing, Churchill China Today did. It said US and UK were good. Rest of the world was terrible, basically. So again, I think we need to keep focused on which markets are doing well and which aren't. And it's not always the case that the UK is doing badly. But Michelmersh also pointed out a highly competitive pricing environment, to use their words. Now, that, again, is distinct from what they said back in May when they were talking about being able to push through price rises. So, yeah, we saw a definite change in tone. Cavendish dropped the forecasts for the current year by 16%, earnings per share next year by 11%. But you've got a very strong balance sheet with modest net cash. And we think overall, pulling it all together, Michelmersh, we think it's dropped sharply in the last few months and it's good value now. It's on a P/E of about 11 on depressed, maybe bottom of the cycle earnings with a sound balance sheet. We think actually, if you take a 2+ year view, this could be a reasonable opportunity. Obviously, short term, I have absolutely no idea what happens to the share price. So yeah, your view, Paul, because you know this better than me. You hold it, don't you?
Yeah, I've held it for a number of years. Yeah, and I mean, I totally concur with what you just said, and also add that the profits were brought down the guidance by about 20-25%, I think, by Canaccord and people like, whereas the shares only dropped about 10% yesterday and bounced back, which says to me actually that there's buying support at the moment, and you can understand why.
Yeah.
Firstly, if the market is competitive, what's the best way of stopping the market being competitive? If you are a rival of Michelmersh, you buy Michelmersh, and it has been basically in the crosshairs of Fortera.
Oh, I see what you mean. Like, another company buys Michelmersh. Yeah.
Yeah, because that helps the pricing, no doubt about it. So I think that's it's a strategic asset. It's a bit of a trophy asset in the UK.
Yeah.
For that.
And it's probably not big enough to invoke anti-competitive laws. No. Although you don't know, it might do.
It's about 6% market share, so I don't think it is. Yeah, okay. They'd have to go. They would go to the competitions, but it'd be fine for any of the big three. I'm absolutely sure. Or even somebody like Brickability as well. And as you rightly point out, you know, the net tangible assets of this is about 77p per share. So yeah. It's absolutely buttons. This is so. Yeah,
you're right. And I looked at the. It's not just the overall numbers as well. With the balance sheet, you have to look at how it's structured and which bits are moving and it looks very comfortable to me. You know, they've got it's got a very nice, comfortable working capital position. It basically obviously it's capital intensive, but it owns all the fixed assets outright. Yeah, it's nicely set up. So Michelmersh, I think, could get through a nuclear winter. You know, well, that's probably exaggerating a bit, but you don't have to worry about an emergency placing or anything like that there.
No, it's absolutely fine. Good. We've got Drew. He's asking a couple of times about Alumask, which is basically the building products business. Got three sectors. I think it does a bit of sort of drainage. It's quite specialist niche parts, a bit of building envelope. Most of it's locked into environmental secular growth trends, about 80%, I believe. They've been bucking the trend, but the shares have been, not surprisingly, I suppose, along with the rest of the sector, have actually been quite weak of late. What's your latest on Alumask?
Well, we really like this. Funnily enough, Drew messaged me last night through Substack and said, Paul, you forgot to mention Alumask in your podcast. Okay. So apologies to Drew for that. We really like it. One of the readers got me onto this a couple of years ago when it was about £1.20, I think, and said, you must look at this, Paul. It's on a P/E of 6. It's growing really well and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, when I did look at it, I thought, wow, this is fantastic. It's overlooked, underpriced, and it's roughly tripled since then. And actually, the shares, I would just come back at you on what you were saying about the shares for Alumask. I think it's held up reasonably well. If you zoom out, if you see, it's actually, so the recent softness, I would say, very impressed with the numbers. I looked at it, where was it? Here it is, I found it. John wrote a section on this one as well. We think it's a quality business. It's got very good pricing power, very good operating margins, and it just seems to have sailed through the tough macro of the last 5 years without a scratch. We don't really understand how they're doing so well when everything else in building products is doing badly. It must. But I asked an engineer friend of mine who's a neighbor in my block of flats. He says, oh, Alumask, yeah, great company, fantastic products, you know, great quality. So I think this is a really nice little business, actually, and it's doing very well. It's only on a PE of about 11. So we think the current price is fully justified on Alumask, yeah.
Yeah, I think it does a lot of stuff that's for like storm water. So yes. Clearly with global climate change, then that's very helpful. And also with ventilation as well. So most of it's secular growth trends rather than sort of like things like bricks or PVC windows and doors and stuff like that.
So yeah, I think you're right. It's specialist products that they've got a very good reputation. I remember having a Zoom with management a while ago, and they were so kind of quiet and modest, sort of modestly competent, I would describe them as. Not flashy or great presenters, just calmly talking through how they're raising margins on the products. And yeah. I think this is a really nice little business, actually. Yeah.
No, I would agree. Okay, good. Let's move to the consumer. We've got Luke. He's asking about XP Factory, which is the owner of the escape rooms concept and the Boom Battle Bars. I think you own it, actually, don't you?
I do. Yeah, I bought them quite recently, actually. It was a trade more than a... Yeah, I quite liked it. I can understand why some people would not be madly impressed with the numbers, because it's not really generating anything more than negligible profits at this stage. But I think it's important to recognize that it's a growth, you know, it's all about bolting on more branches. They've got the central infrastructure, and as it grows, they're negotiating better and better deals on drinks and food and utilities and so on. So it's a scale up type situation where you should see the margins start to really improve. And the way I look at it is, given how tough the sector is, that the fact that this thing has grown from nothing with very little capital over the last 5 years, when all around it competitors are going under, and they've managed to wash their face cash flow wise without further dilution, I think is really impressive. I think if you take a step back and look forward 2 or 3 years, when hopefully margins in hospitality might rebuild a bit, or somewhat, you know, and lots of competition dropping away. They said in the most recent figures that it's experiential leisure, as you say, and it said so many competitors are struggling now, there's going to be consolidation opportunities or just people exiting the market. So I think as a slow burn thing, I'm my personal price target is double to triple the current share price, but that's obviously several years away and based on things working out well. Downside risk is quite limited. Actually, its balance sheet's not too bad, and it's got a £10 million Barclays facility, which means it's not going to need to dilute, in my opinion. So some of the bears were saying a year or two ago that, oh, you know, it can't possibly grow without more equity. Well, they've been proven wrong so far. So you looked at it, Paul?
I have many a time. It just isn't the kind of stock I typically invest in. Yeah, you know, I'm not very good at consumer. Every time I go into it, I get absolutely wellied. So I'm now trying to once bitten, twice shy, so to speak.
Fair enough.
Okay, we got John. He's asking about JD Sports. Now, they came out with a trading update a couple of weeks ago. The question is centering really along the lines of, they've got a big US retail footprint. And presumably they've been competing, like all local retailers, against this de minimis goods being imported from around the world. And now tariffs have been locked in everywhere. So you can't actually parallel import without having a big tax charge for goods. Will these guys be a beneficiary in their US business because they're not competing against all these people importing under $800, which was the case before?
To be honest, I hadn't actually thought of that angle on it. I mean, I do hold this personally. I bought them when they were about between 90p and a pound, thinking it wouldn't go any lower. And of course, whenever you think that these days, they just carry on going down and down and down. So to me, the valuation didn't really make much sense. So I bought some more near the low, actually, about 68p, I think it was. And it's come back up quite strongly. It's rebounded about 50% from the lows. There have been several of the big name brokers putting out more bullish notes, actually, on JD Sports, although there was one slightly negative one today. 51% owned by Pentland. You do want 51%. You do wonder if they might try and take it private while it's so cheap. I think anything that wasn't another profit warning works for me. You know, in the last update a couple of days ago, I think, was basically in line, just said, you know, I think they might, I think there was a slight negative in it, but I can't remember what it was. I just think it's oversold. So, yeah, I don't want to hold it forever, but I think personally JD Sports should be £1.50, £1.60. That's how I value it. So I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah. It's quite interesting. As a broader point, though, isn't it? If you've, you know, any retailer that sells goods less than $800 in the States, they've now got some sort of like protection against the likes of, you know, Amazon, you know, Amazon Marketplace, Shein, Temu, all these kind of guys who have been importing in just on the single. Because $800 an item is actually quite a lot direct.
It's a lot, isn't it? Yeah, I think the UK equivalent, if I remember correctly, £135, is it?
Yeah, I think so, yeah, yeah.
And of course, the UK government hasn't tackled that issue yet, has it? Yeah. Whereas the Americans have. But yeah, I always take the view that I think the best quality retailers can kind of normally work their way around these type of issues. Yeah, I mean, the big issue with JD Sports was competitors discounting, wasn't it? Because it's premium branded products. And JD dug their heels and said, we're not going to discount. Yeah. We'll try not to anyway. And so far, it seems to be, I just don't see why this is on valuation as low as it is. It's not a business I want to hold forever. But there again, if you look at like the 10-year track record for the P&L and the shares, it's absolutely astonishing. You know, they've grown this thing. It's doing really a big self-funded international rollout, opening hundreds of new stores each year, buying up competitors. It's a very, very ambitious business. So I think the revenue is over 10 billion a year now, isn't it, or something?
I don't know, actually. But no, it's a massive business, isn't it?
It's a massive business, yeah. Very big in America as well. So I think it's just oversold. So yeah, I'm happy to run with it and see what happens.
Good. Okay. On the in the same consumer sector, we've got Nearly's asking about Supreme, which I think is 50% of its business is vaping, and 50% now is non-vaping. So non-vape is clearly drinks, Typhoo tea, batteries, lighting, and they just bought the acquisition, bought somebody, I think it was 1001, which is the upholstery and carpet cleaner, that heritage brand.
Yeah, that's right. We thought it was it was a very small deal. I think they only paid 1.65 million for it, but it's a recognisable household name that's been around for decades, hasn't it? So I think they're canny buyers of Supreme. They're real hands-on entrepreneurs who've got, I think, an excellent track record of just spotting product and market niches. But you do have to bear in mind, obviously, it's still basically a vaping company. I think it's three quarters of the gross profit or something when you include the division that they call something else, but is actually also vaping products. So let's not, you know, let's not get carried away with that. So it's never going to be on a particularly high rating. But we think it's okay. Yeah, probably good. Priced about right is my overall view.
I think it trades at roughly around about, is it 9.5 times
PE? Yeah, it's about 10 times. That was the figure I had in my head. Yeah, I think that's right. Which is probably about the right price for that type of business. You know, I wouldn't I wouldn't pay more for it personally, but that's a decision each investor can make. But as you can see from the chart, you know, it's been a nice trade, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things, isn't it, really? Because I think they've bought most of their non-vaping business has just been bought. So you've got Clearly Drinks, you've got 1001, and you've got Typhoo Tea, which have all been sort of break-even and have been turned around. And therefore, if you actually do it in a sum of the parts, vaping, non-vaping, then you could argue FMCG goods products that are growing should be on a much higher PE multiple than 9 times. Whereas the vaping, yes, I could understand that. And therefore, for a blended, you know, I think that's the opportunity.
I think that's a really good point, actually. Again, a bit like you were saying with Avintrans, you could split this into two, couldn't you? And value them differently. I suppose the key point is really with Typhoo and with Clearly Drinks and the 1001, the latest purchase, we don't yet know if they can turn them round. That's the issue. They've got to demonstrate that, haven't they? At the moment, it's aspirations. But certainly in terms of, I thought they paid quite a fair bit for clearly drinks. That was
about 15 million, I think it was.
Yeah, I thought that was a little bit warm. But look, what do I know? They're not fools. They know what they're doing. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, how they integrate and change these businesses. I like the model, though, taking a well-known brand, taking it out of administration or picking it up for peanuts, and then just doing some common sense stuff to improve it.
Yeah, you're a tough man. You're a tough man to please. I mean, they bought Clearly Drinks about June, summer of last year. Okay. Right. Now, if you remember last year and the year before that, the summer was awful. This company, Clearly Drinks, made bottled water. They will have had an absolute bonanza this year. Mm, I bet you they've been knocking the ball out of the park with bottled water.
Could be. No, I think let's just see the evidence. Well, you know, before I think before attributing much of a value to the recently acquired brands, I think we need the figures, don't we? Yeah.
No, you don't. No, you have to basically do that. The share price moves. Okay, we've got let's go to IT. We've got Colin. He's asking about Maintel, which came out with, unfortunately, a bit of a mega profit warning this morning. I think it basically does sort of communication software to the public sector and the corporate sector. Quite a tough industry if you're an implementer, which I think these guys are. Shares are down about 15-20% today.
Yeah, we looked at this one again today. Where is it on my list? It's only 20 million market cap. I couldn't believe it. Mm. Incredible. Unfortunately, Cavendish have updated the figures and it's basically wiped out pretty much all of 2025's profit. And it's lowered next year by 62%. It's a bit of a shame because they were apparently Maintel was bidding for three big contracts. They got two of them, but they missed one. And, you know, higher margin stuff, I guess. And they also said there were some delays in pipeline closures. So that's just clobbered the profitability, unfortunately. Mm. I think it's still got quite substantial owner managed or director holdings. Our main concern is the balance sheet. We don't like the balance sheet, negative net tangible asset values. We think it's a little bit elevated risk, so we've gone with amber red on this just because to flag the higher risk. But I don't know. This is a bit more your sort of thing, the mind pool. Any views from you on Maintel?
Yeah, I mean, because they basically implement and customize sort of like communication software, and it may be for sort of call centers or just within the company or contact centers.
Yeah.
More of that area is going to be impacted by agentic AI, you know, chatbots. And therefore, if you take people out of the system, then it may actually reduce the target addressable market for them. So if that's the case, I don't know. I mean, their gross margins are about 30%, which says to me that it's a pretty tough area.
Those are really good points. Although I have heard rumblings generally, you know, on just reading media commentary and all the rest of it, there are people questioning this AI boom and saying, well, apparently there are very few cases of it adding any actual commercial benefit.
Yeah.
And, you know, the more you and I deal with these chatbots and whatnots, I think the performance of them is often very disappointing and frustrating. Yeah. Although I did deal with a very good one at Amex recently, where it was obviously a computer trying to work out what I wanted, and it dealt with it very well. So I don't know. I'm still... It's in my don't know tray, all this AI stuff.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, I think you're probably citing the research report which came out just recently from MIT in the States, and they said 95% of AI within corporates hasn't actually generated any value.
Wow.
However, I would just take that to experimentation if it's right anyway, because AI is just fabulous. I use it all the time. ChatGPT is brilliant. It's basically 10, you know, sort of private secretaries I've got working for me constantly, and it's changed my view. It's fun for our job, for research. It is just brilliant in my view. So, you know, I'm a massive fan, and I cannot see how it's going to fail. I just think there's massive value, certainly for me.
Interesting.
Anyway.
Yeah, I've had very mixed results, but you should make a video, Paul, of demonstrating how you use it. And no, I'm serious, because then it would teach other investors like me in the audience, show us examples of what you use it for. And honestly, I really urge you to do that. So
I'll tell you what, I'll interview ChatGPT live. What about that?
Most of us are dying to know how to use this amazing new tool. I mean, I've tried it out for lots of stuff and found it a bit patchy, full of errors sometimes as well.
Yeah, good. Okay, we've got Sarah, she's the same sector. She's asking about Kainos, which is basically a value-added reseller of software and also does implementation. It's a big sort of like a partner for Workday software, which is HR and... I think it's a bit CRM there as well. They've got, and they came out with a trading update, I think last week or this week, I can't remember, but the shares have obviously jumped up quite high on the back of this relief rally. What was quite interesting, I thought, and I'd be interested, is that within this business, they seem to have a very £100 million ARR software company that tailors Workday to its customers, hence it gives it very good margins. But what was your take?
Well, I read the announcement and I thought, oh, this is quite good. It was strangely worded, the RNS. It was on Monday, wasn't it? It basically read as in line, but they were pretty clearly saying they thought they were going to beat, you know. I think it was a revenue beat, wasn't it? And then EBITDA was in line, I think. But then they said, oh, they're being prudent, not raising guidance. So they were making it pretty clear that things are going quite well. They said all three divisions are performing well. And I think they've got quite a bit of UK public sector exposure where the budget and the government sort of put things on ice, didn't it? And it's basically saying now those are flowing through now recently. So we thought this was pretty good, actually. I was amazed it went up nearly 20%. And I was going to mark it neutral, amber, because it was up 20%. My colleague John had another look at it and he said, Paul, actually, I think you should bump this up to amber green. It's better than you think. So it's got net cash, it's doing buybacks, it's got a 4% dividend yield, it's got a strong balance sheet. You had a very positive tone in this it was an H1 trading update, wasn't it? New projects mobilizing across all three divisions. So actually, on reflection, we went with Amber Green because it does look good, you know, and the forecasts for next year show a substantially up 51p earnings forecast for next year. So you could argue anything under £10 a share is reasonably priced, I would say. So do you like it?
Well, what sort of like really surprised me is how they've got about £400 million turnover, of which £100 million is that software business that's growing really fast. Okay. And give you an idea what they do. They take, like, you might have a big customer like Diageo that needs to implement a, say, European directive for wage, you know, transparency. And Workday don't want to put that functionality because it's regional. And therefore, these guys develop that functionality within Workday with their permission, with the APIs, and then sell that functionality to the likes of Diageo and other people. And that business, that software company, is going like a train. It really is. And if you put a, it's difficult to know, but I'd have to look at the, if they've got the real breakdown in profitabilities. But you could easily see a very strong double-digit growing software company, 100 million, sales. Five times sales would be £500 million, and the market cap's only £1 billion. So half of this value of the business could just be through what it does on its software company. So and that's going to be sticky recurring revenue stream. So I hadn't realised that. There's a really nice crown jewel software business in this.
How interesting. Well, that's news to me. Thanks, Paul. That's very pleasing to hear. I had it in my head that it was kind of almost like a people business, selling consultancy days at significant markups. But as you say, if there's a rapidly growing recurring revenue software business in there, that changes the perspective and the valuation completely, doesn't it? I think, am I right in thinking it's based in Belfast?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, it is.
Yeah. No, we like it. Yeah, we think it's a good business. Yeah.
Good. Okay, just changing sectors. We've got the secret travel agent asking about e-energy, which I think does basically implementation of sort of like solar PV stuff for corporate customers as a service, and likewise with LED lights and energy saving stuff. And the idea is that, as we all know, the UK's energy prices for corporates are about four times more expensive than they are in the States. Oof. And about double the cost they are in Europe. And therefore, to help UK corporates and the public sector, which is what they do with schools and stuff, implement if energy efficient new technologies as a service, because it gets, these things get funded, I think, through the banks like NatWest, and they've got, I think, Redaptive they're using in the States who do it. Anyway, he's asking about, have you ever had a look at e-energy at all? Because the shares have done pretty well, actually.
Yeah, this, I don't know if I can add much value on this. We did have a look at it on, we've looked at it twice this year, in January and again in July. We couldn't really make our mind up on it. It is still loss-making. But the operational gearing is improving, apparently, and they're keeping their central costs flat. This was the commentary with its interim results to June, and it said the outlook was in line for the full year, expects to be cash generative in the full year. So there's nothing really on the balance sheet, asset or cash-wise. So I don't really know how to value this one. To be fair, so let me have a look at the charts. You've got that on screen, have you, Paul?
Oh, no, I couldn't get it. On my normal provider, it doesn't give it so small. But I'm just gonna,
it's very volatile, isn't it? Gosh, yeah, it just spikes up and down. So I think for us, it's probably in the don't know tray. So, I know that the guy who was inquiring about this has messaged me personally about it as well. So I'm sorry, we can't really give you anything. Much more to go on that. I think we just need to see a few more years track record, really.
Yeah, I think it's in a good space. And the key of it, like anything, is being able to get sufficient funders to put up the working capital to be able to fund these as energy as a service. And if you can continue doing that without the actual, you know, the actual break in that funding, then you'll do very well. Because I'm pretty sure the customers want it, particularly schools, for instance, because they're so budget conscious and the public sector, that anything as energy as a service that saves them is just a no-brainer.
Yeah, this is ringing bells in my head now. I think, was this the one where they did a partnership deal with NatWest? NatWest provided the funding for the customers to buy the product. Yeah, I think it is an interesting concept, this. In terms of profitability, though, there's no track record at all, basically. Just rising revenues and kind of flatlining, oscillating. Well, no, it's losses all but 1 year. So it's not really commercially proven yet, but it does sound an interesting concept, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, it does. Okay, good. Let's jump again to another sector. Let's go to Johnson Services, which does sort of B2B services for it does cleans sort of blue collar workwear and stuff, which is about 25%. And then the main body now is cleaning, I think, and all laundrettes for the catering sector and the hotel sector. So it takes bed linen and sheets and stuff like that, and goes and cleans them and sends them back. The shares responded pretty well actually this week.
We think it's very good. We've liked this for years. Yesterday that was, isn't it? Results came out, and we thought it was pretty good. It's just a nice quality business. This is another one, actually, where, going back to what I was on about before, they're focusing on driving up that operating margin. And they said that it was an inline update for calendar 25. H1 results, that was it, announced another share buyback of 25 million, which is about nearly 5% of the market cap. And that's on top of a 30 million buyback already done. H1 profitability was good, up 18%. And they say that the adjusted operating margin is on track to reach 14% in 2026. Now, that's despite high energy costs, because I imagine this would be a heavy energy user. So it's got all the look and feel to me of a really well-run business. So I think it looks very good, actually. PEs are only about 13, so we think there's upside to maybe about £2 on this Johnson Service Group. So not really my type of thing, so I'm not interested in buying me personally, but I do think it's good.
I think you're exactly spot on. It's got barriers to entry. I was looking at the actual EBIT margins. They're over 13%, the operating
it's not bad
margins.
Is it
which says to me the big barrier to entry is scale, economies of scale, and these guys must be bigger than anybody else in the sector. And on that basis, you know, they've just locked it in because nobody can compete on price. And it's that whole distribution network, isn't it? It's sort of like being able, having that route density to pick up all the linen and to get the linen back to them within 24 hours.
Yeah, that sounds sensible. And it must be a hell of a job managing that, mustn't it? Can you imagine the operational details of it would be hellish, wouldn't they? So I'd hate to work for a company like that. But it looks like a well-managed business. They've done quite a few acquisitions over the years. One of my readers did raise a query, quite a detailed accounting query, about capitalizing inventories and what the depreciation policy is. I remember that was an issue with Johnson Services Group ages ago. I think it was about 15, 20 years ago. They ran into big trouble in the financial crisis when a lot of their clients with branded workwear went bust, rendering the workwear worthless. So that is actually probably a good point that if anyone's got the time, they could maybe check what the accounting policies are and make sure they're prudent.
Yeah. Good. Okay, we just move to we've got gold, because obviously it's now got above $3,500 per ounce. We've got Edward asking about Hochschild, and we've got Bruce asking about Serebii gold. Hochschild, let's just talk about Hochschild first. It basically is a South American gold miner that has got its big facility, I think, in Peru, and one in Argentina. But the problem they've had just recently has been in Brazil. an open cast mine for gold, which I think has been hit by some of the weather there. I don't know if you have any views. I mean, these all the shares look like rocket ships over the last 12 months.
Yeah, no, unfortunately, I just don't get involved at all in this sector. It's not because of any judgment on it. And people say, oh, well, you're an idiot then. Look at that chart. You should be buying gold shares. It's just not my area of expertise. You know, I literally can't cover everything. And I only want to look at areas where I think I might have some sort of edge, hopefully. And yeah, it's just not an area I look at all. But good luck to people. And feel free to discuss these shares on my Substack. You know, it's not just because I don't look at them. Other people can. And you know, I love seeing people making money. So, do you dabble in this sort of stuff, Paul?
I don't typically go to miners, but I would say I was just looking at the numbers, and Hochschild's on about just over 6x EBITDA.
I couldn't find it.
Yeah, sorry, I did have it a moment ago. What was it? Hang on, let me just.
How are we spelling the name?
Yeah, no, it's the ticker is HOC.
HOC.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Hochschild. That's very Germanic, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, look at that chart. Bloody hell, over 3 years, people have done well on that, haven't they? Three or four bags. PE, and you get a very modest dividend yield, don't you? Asset backed. Obviously subject to the movements of the gold price, I suppose, because it's a producer, isn't it?
The other one is Serebii Gold, which was Bruce was asking about. And look at the shares there. I mean, they've gone from 20p to over £2. And looking at the numbers, and they're a Brazilian gold miner, and they trade at they sell at 3x EBITDA, so it's half the valuation of Hochschild. You'd have to have a look at the longevity of the mines and how much resource they've still got. But even so, I mean,
CapEx and obviously the big variable is the gold price itself, isn't it? Look at that chart. Fantastic. Well done to anyone who specializes in that area. I'll look forward to a ride in your Bentley.
Gold in them hills, so they speak.
Yeah,
I know. Okay, good. Let's move to let's go for some of the industrial stocks. We've got one very, very cheap. We've got Vesuvius, which basically just recently bought the what it does is it does specific stuff that helps molten metal, things like steel and aluminium and copper and stuff. It got in for insulation. It bought the Morgan Advanced Materials division just recently. Obviously not surprising with GDP, it's going through a tough patch, but the price actually at the moment, I know we talked about cheap industrials, but the price, I was looking at it, and I think it's trading at less than 10x PE with Is it 6.5% dividend yield?
Yeah, it is. We flagged this on 6th of August. The H1 results came out. We did a brief write-up on that. Yeah, it said broadly in line for H1, so that's slightly below, isn't it? And tough market conditions. Then it said challenging market conditions will persist for the rest of the year. And H2, it gave guidance that H2 it would expect to be similar to H1, which we thought was in line. The balance sheet's all right. As you say, quite rightly, Paul, it's a nice value share, isn't it? Low PE, yeah. Just about 10, nearly 7% yield. I mean, you can't argue with that. So, yeah, for value investors, I would say Vesuvius, we quite like it. We're amber green on that one. I have no idea what the company does or what its competitors are. Or do you know what I mean? We just do a quick overview and then we leave the detailed research up to our members to get on with, you know. But, yeah, looks like it's got potential for value investors.
Yeah, I think the downside is probably something like China property, because they haven't been building as many sort of like, you know, big construction projects. But equally, there's going to be a lot of metal which is going to be required in the defense sector, things like those frigates which have just been ordered by Scandinavia or by Norway. So it's sort of puts and takes, I think. And I think if you're buying at the bottom of trough earnings at 10 times PE, I think it's not bad value, actually.
Yeah. And I think I haven't got the figures in front of me, but I seem to recall it makes a reasonably good operating margin, this one, doesn't it? Which tells you that it's obviously got some pricing power and the customers like its services, products or whatever. So, but potentially worth doing some more digging on for value investors, definitely.
Yeah. Okay. We've got a question coming in from Varun Kapoor. He's asking about GB Group, which is the identity company. And again, I think the shares have really started carried on declining. They must be getting really quite cheap now.
I agree. This was one I flagged up. Is it GBGP, the ticker? I can't remember.
No, it's GBG.
GBG. I didn't press return. That's why it didn't come up. This came up. I think I mentioned this in my podcast last night, actually. I did a quick scan of the market looking for things that look really oversold and potential bargains. And I think GB Group is possibly one of those. As you say, it hasn't really stopped falling, has it? Or hasn't bounced. The only thing is it X growth? I think we discussed this quite recently, actually. And the trouble is... and it's got Forex headwinds as well. Last updated us in line for Q1 and starting a buyback. This is the one that's de-geared very nicely, isn't it? It had took on rather too much debt for acquisitions, but it's quite rapidly paying it off. And I think it's moving from AIM to the main market in November.
That's correct. Yes. Yeah.
So I think this looks worth people having a look at. Obviously, we never recommend anything. These are just personal opinions. And I don't own any myself, but I'm tempted to dip my toe in with a small sort of opening size position here now that it's sorted out its balance sheet. The net debt is well down below 1x now. So, yeah, potentially interesting, worth people having a closer look, I would say.
Yeah, good. Okay, we've got a couple of quick questions. We've got Tim Ewington. He's asking about Greggs, basically Mr. Sausage Roll. He says they're down 50% in the year. Clearly, they're out of favour by all investors. I think the sausage rolls are still selling pretty well. But what's your latest on Greggs?
Well, I like it. I mean, I bought them at around 17, 18, 19 pounds, something like that. And I'm underwater on them currently, which I think the market's being overly pessimistic about this. I mean, there's a whole range of bull and bear points that have been done to death. So I don't think we need to go into those again. But, you know, it has said it's having a challenging year. We know the reasons why: shoplifting, you know, consumer, lower footfall in the hot weather. There are all sorts of I think they've lost their way a bit operationally. The staff are fiddling around with coffee machines when they should be just ramming people through the tills. As we know, shoplifting are absolutely off the scale now. Ridiculous, because there's no deterrent. Paying is just optional, and don't get me onto that. But anyway, but you see, it's got a strong balance sheet. I think it'll fix these problems. They're all operational challenges, I would say. I don't think there's anything fundamentally wrong with the business at all. So give it to... The other thing is, is it near the end of the road in terms of expansion? That's a good question. Weight loss jabs, you know, could be starting to have an impact on it. So there are all these various factors, but I just feel the bear points have been overdone to the downside. It's still a really quality business that generates superb profits. Bit of a glitch, in my opinion, rather than the, anything being fundamentally broken. So do you beg to differ, Paul? Or
no, I think it's a good product. I still like the sausage rolls and the products, and I think they're great value, no doubt about it. I just think that it's now getting quite competitive. However, having said that, when you're looking at sort of 12 and a half times PE for a quality compounder, actually, that's pretty damn good value, really, isn't it? A lot of bad news has already been baked in.
That's my view. I don't badum tish. Yeah, I don't want to hold it forever. You know, for me, this is a sort of, I think it's the bad news has been overdone. But I've got a very, very long term track record of buying far too early. So normally, if I think it's oversold, there'll be another leg down.
Okay, we've got Richard Leppington. He's asking about McBride, which does it makes the detergents and cleaners for supermarkets on their own brand. It's sort of like, white labeling those type of products. Shares have sold, having done very, very well, the balance sheet and the shares have actually been sold off a bit. But what's your take on it?
Well, we've not had anything since mid-July from McBride that I've spotted, unless there was anything else that's cropped up. I mean, we've got to fully recognise what a fabulous turnaround this was from a really near-death position about 2 years ago. However, they've also pushed their operating margins now above, because of favourable agreements with retailers, where they set the deals up for a year typically, and then their costs reduced, whatever. I think they're making supernormal profits at the moment. So I think it should be on a low PE, because the retailers are obviously pushing back and are driving prices back down again. And they pretty much said that the last couple of times they've reported. So I'm not surprised to see the peaks come off a bit. However, you know, it's come down quite a lot, hasn't it? So let me just quickly put in the ticker MCB, isn't it?
Yeah.
See what the current valuation metrics are. Yeah, 5.3 times, you see. Very, very low. But of course, you've got to adjust that for the pension contributions, because they don't flow through the P&L. Balance sheet, I think debt is down a lot, isn't it? Much reduced. So yeah, maybe it's worth a fresh look, but I wouldn't expect it to be able to maintain the high profit margins that it's making at the moment. And it's told us that, you know, so there's nothing. Not really for me, but good luck to anyone who has a dabble in it.
Has it told you that, actually, Paul? Because when we last talked about McBride about 2 months ago, I then actually communicated with the CEO, and he was adamant that actually he could hold the margins.
At what level, though?
At the current level.
Really? Because in the RNS statements, it has said, was making an above long-term average operating margin. So that's interesting. If they think they can make those margins stick, then that would certainly be a bullish point, wouldn't it? Yeah, I was only going by what I read in previous RNSs. You know, I didn't make it up.
I'll double check that and I'll get back next week.
But that'd be interesting. If he can tell us what the sustainable long-term operating margin is, that would be good information, wouldn't it?
Yeah, good. Okay, we'll have the final one. We've got Cento Annie. He's asking about Uracell Building Products Company. I'm guessing it's probably a similar chart to most building products companies.
Yeah, it is. This one, funnily enough, I mentioned this in last night's podcast as well. It came up in one of my reviews. Yeah, I think it's attractive. It's a very nice business, decent margins, pricing power, 5% yield, strong balance sheet, forward PE 7.6. I mean, what's not to like out of that lot, other than the fact that you might get a profit warning and you might have to look through, you know, another year of the sector being soft. But it's very nice, I think. For me personally, if I'm going into this sector, just buy a basket of about five of them. Pick the best ones. So I'd probably go for Uracell, Alimask. I don't know. I've gone blank. But do you know what I mean? I think because one of them, at least one, is bound to warn on profits, aren't they? And you don't want to take a 30% hit by having all your eggs in one basket. So that's my view on. Yeah. Do you follow Uracell, Paul?
I do, and I like it. I think it does. It's windows and doors, isn't it? Recycled plastics, I think. Large, big chunk, but I think it's very well run. and therefore it makes decent margins. I can't remember exactly, but I mean, I've already got exposure into Michelmersh, so I probably wouldn't get any more. But I think it's a good quality business. Yeah.
And they reacted. I think it seems to be well run. I mean, you'd never really know unless you're an insider in a business, but it seems to be well run. I remember when the downturn first hit, they acted instantly to strip out costs. And but you do wonder if when you've got a branch network like they have, about 200 branches nationally, how much more can you lower the staffing count? You know, you've got to have that level of customer service, haven't you? If they, you know what builders are like, if they turn up and they have to wait 10 or 15 minutes to get served, the air will turn blue, won't it? And they'll go somewhere else.
Too damn right. Okay, guys, we've been going now for just over 70 minutes. Thanks, everyone, for your questions. Apologies, I'm going to get through all of them. Obviously, hold them and we'll ask them next week. Haven't yet decided whether it's Wednesday or Thursday of 2 o'clock, but I'll let everybody know as near the time. So thanks again, Paul. Terrific as always.
And I'm glad to see
you've got... I'm glad to see you've got your Ethernet connection in now. That technology is brilliant, isn't it?
God, I was having kittens last week. But I'm glad it's worked this time. I know,
that worked perfectly. All right, thanks, guys, and see you next week.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.